Stories, awakening, possibility, social impact. Creating a culture of compassion, connection, and collaboration. You are listening to Hollyhock Talks, a podcast about the teachers and luminaries that make Hollyhock extraordinary. Hollyhock is Canada's leading leadership learning center, located on Cortez Island. Hollyhock Talks brings a little piece of Hollyhock magic to you, wherever you are listening. You're listening to Hollyhock Talks. I'm Farin Israeli, and I'm thrilled to be here with Jill Purse.
Jill Purse.
She is a pioneer of the Healing Voices movement and Healing Ancestors movement, and I'm thrilled to be with her today to talk about the work you do in family constellations and healing and the work that you do in ancestral healing. Jill, can you start off by telling us a little bit about how you got into this kind of work?
Oh, goodness. I've been teaching. I started originally being interested in how form comes into being. This is many, many years ago. And then I realized that you know, if you vibrate seamless, formless substance with sound, you get all the kind of patterns that you see around you with nature. So I began to be very, very interested in the creative power of sound. And then I realized that we'd gone silent. The more sophisticated the world became, the more silent we became. And so I spent 40 years reintroducing people to their voices, you know, all the ways in which people had sung together, chanted together, had been eroded from our society. Sacred music had been hijacked by the professionals. So I found a way in which I could reintroduce people to their voices, even if they'd been told they couldn't sing, by introducing a form of chanting from Central Asia, where you chant on a single note and amplify the harmonics, which makes this extraordinarily magical and unearthly sound, which people say sounds like the music of the spheres. So I used that as a kind of core running through, and then introduced people, gave voice workshops long before there were any workshops, let alone people interested in the effect of sound or sound workshops. So I did that for many, many years. And then I began to find, I started to do a ceremony to honor the ancestors, and I found that people's lives started changing. And then I did a kind of ancestral detective. I'm talking over the last 40 years. I then started doing individual ancestral detective work and began to see the relationship between things that people's ancestors had done and the consequences and the patterns of redemption that went on down through the lines, where people found themselves doing things that redeemed things that earlier members had done, even though what they'd done at the time and within the zeitgeist at the time might have been very worthy. But we have an inability to see the consequences of our actions down the line many years. So people have a way of finding things that they do in their lives become things which unconsciously, without them even knowing what their ancestors did, redeem things that they actually did. So then that gradually developed I started combining that with what's come to be called family constellations. So what I do now is I work in, so it's based on the idea that, this work is based on the idea that whenever there's some kind of a trauma going back generations, in other words, when family members are separated, but you usually by some kind of interruption into the notion of the normal unfolding of a lifetime. So early death, death on battlefield, death in childbirth, accidents, suicides, murders, incarcerations, mental incapacities, incarcerations for dodgy dealing or for mental illness, abusers, in people causing injustices, all the kind of things that can happen in families and do happen in all families. Whenever they do happen, they cause a pattern of trauma. And that pattern of trauma is very conservative. It maintains itself down through the generations, and people in every generation are drawn to it. You know, when there are certain kind of resonances between people of a generation, they'll find themselves following in the same pattern that earlier members did, even if they didn't know those people existed, and then find themselves excluding themselves again from the field. It's all about exclusion. So a field of family and ancestors is an inclusive whole. And when you have people who die young or who rejected or forgotten, they become outliers and everybody feels bad. But as soon as you the people who are following those earlier people, as soon as they realize that they are relating to these other people, and they are brought back and honored, and the original people identified and recognized, remembered, honored, then the current members of the family feel good. Not only the people who are doing the work, you know, in the workshop, but other members of the family, in some miraculous way, find themselves transforming at the same time that the other members are doing the work in the workshop. It's quite uncanny and quite extraordinary. And I work ceremonially. Over the years, I found that it's very important to, when you're trying to change in some way, you know, people come to these kind of things, workshops of any kind, because they think they could be better people, kinder people, more generous people, more enlightened people, whatever the reason is. But they want to change from what they were to what they want to become. And when people do that, when they go home again, they usually default, you know, they go back to the default them and carry on as they were before. So I found over the years of working that a much more powerful way of working is if you work ceremonially, where the other people actually witness what you're doing. You know, it's a bit like if you get married, you know, and you invite everybody to the wedding. And in fact, there's been a very interesting study done, and they wanted to find out what kind of things led to stable marriages. And they looked into everything, people who'd known each other for years, common interests, you know, paying a lot of money for a wedding, inviting lots of people to the wedding, but not spending very much. All the very different ingredients, and they found that the correlation, the principal correlation that correlated to people staying together longest, was the amount of people you invited to the wedding. In other words, the numbers of people who witnessed you changing from being unmarried to being married, and who therefore could uphold you in the new state, so that you knew that they knew that you knew that they knew that you were now married and not the default you that was unmarried. And it had nothing to do with the amount it was spent on the wedding. That, in fact, had the opposite effect. So I'd always known this. I only just saw this study last week, but I'd always known this. And, in fact, I gave the wedding as an example, because we have destination weddings now where people go off and get married underwater in Mexico or something, and then come back and tell their friends we're married, and they say, oh, well, really? So what, you know? So anyway, I found that the power of ceremony is absolutely, you know, crucial, you know, I find, anyway, in allowing people to have the witnesses who witness what they're doing and going into the new state of being and then upholding you in it. So I do this work ceremonially and shamanically and, you know, using chant and so forth. And it changes people's lives in a way that talking therapies and other therapies find really can't. You know, if you have a problem and you talk about it, you don't really access it, because most of our problems and patterns are deeply rooted in our unconscious. They come from our reactive patterns to things that happen in our lives at a very, very early age, and we really have no access to them, certainly not an ability to change them. Whereas if you have a means of tapping into the unconscious in a way that this work does, then, you know, you can change things immediately and very dramatically and very quickly. And the effect is, you know, nothing short of miraculous. And then really magical things seem to happen to people, you know, left field, things they weren't expecting, really wonderful things.
That sounds fascinating. What I'm struck by in listening to your answer is how divorced we are from ritual and ceremony and any kind of work that actually connects us to the past and to our ancestors here in Western culture.
Oh, totally, yes. I mean, rituals, I mean, just like I said, you know, these destination weddings where people go off and and get married in secret and so on. So we've got very little ceremony left in our lives, and people did it from time immemorial because they knew it had a very powerful effect. So when I'm working, I really like to use it and I use it in many forms of my work. I do week-long ceremonies where I've reactivated the mandala, and the group becomes the mandala and spends a week working on themselves, chanting continuously and doing all kinds of things. And again, that's done ceremonially. So I found working ceremony is a very important thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to come back to something you said very early on when you talked about the power of sound and vibration. And you mentioned that the creative power of sound. So when we learn to use our voices and create sound, tell us a little bit about that creative power.
Well, if you, there's a lot of work done with showing the effect of sound on different forms of material, water or viscous pastes or powders, where they're put on a vibrating membrane, for example, and then vibrated with different forms of sound. And what you see are these just exquisite patterns, that are like the patterns you see on the back of butterflies and zebras. And they're these very ordered patterns that just manifest through the sound. In fact, usually when you have a vibrating plate, it's thought that the powder, for example, gathers in the part of the plate that's not vibrating. So you get a map of what of the vibration in matter.
And in term, does that have an impact internally on our organs and our bodies as well as externally?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the overtone chanting, which I teach, is the most ordered form of sound. Overtones are supremely ordered. They come in particular intervals, when you through resonance you amplify them so they become audible. Normally they're not audible, and our Western music is out of tune. So when you amplify these harmonics, you're inducting an intense order into the system. And in different languages that describe enlightenment, very often you talk about diamond mind, the words used to describe the development of consciousness are evocations of order. A diamond is the molecules that you get in a lead pencil, which are where in the pencil, the carbon atoms are completely disordered. But if you order them as ordered as you possibly can, you get the diamond, which is absolutely transparent and hard, can cut any other material. So. We talk about the diamond body or diamond mind as ways of describing the development of consciousness. So in many traditions, this notion of the induction of order is very important, and that's what comes when you chant in a particular way, use your voices in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. And the work that you do in terms of family constellation integrates that sound healing aspect in terms of also producing harmony and order for the spirits or the ancestors that continue to affect us in our lives in the present.
Well, what I do, I don't do the overtone chanting in the family constellation work, but what I do is we do all kinds of other chanting, mantra, and we do an ancient trance dance for invoking the ancestors and various other things, which is a way of amplifying the resonant field of the family and ancestors, making the work much more powerful and much more accessible, and allowing people to do the work in the name of something much bigger than themselves. So it's not just a psychological process, but it's embedded in the spiritual one.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the practice of mantra.
Mantra is a way of chanting. Very often words, they're not usually sentences, they're usually words strung together, each of which you can translate usually and has a meaning, the sentences don't normally have a meaning. It's a way of lulling the mind into thinking it's in a safe in the safe world of discursive thought, whereas actually you're dealing with the sort of pure syllables. So when certain mantras are, you know, teachings are given around certain mantras. Each syllable, you know, Om Mani Padme Hum, which everybody knows, you know, there are teachings around Om Mani Padme Hum. Each syllable has got a week of teachings around. So it's not a discursive sentence. It's a way of bamboozling the mind into thinking it's in a familiar realm of language, only to be taken beyond it into something much more powerful. And when you're tuning a mantra into a mantra, you're tuning into the stream of transmission from a particular lineage where each person has traditionally become enlightened through chanting that particular sound. So if you tune using that particular sound, then you're tuning into the field of enlightenment, and in turn adding to it, so that when it comes to the next person, it's more powerful than it was before. So you're tuning into a field and adding to it by your own development, the powers of attainment, or siddhis, they're called. And so you're tuning into these streams of transmission. So traditionally, you don't read mantras in a book. You have to receive the lung or the breath or the transmission of them from somebody who's mastered them.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating, the work that you do. Tell us a little bit about doing the work at Hollyhock and what the place adds to the work that you do.
Well, it's always, you know, special to do the work in a very beautiful place. And I've been going to Hollyhock for 28 years now, and love to go there and love to do the work. It's a very, very beautiful place. And you know, when people are doing the work in a beautiful place, residentially, you know, it really adds to the power of the work.
What is the highest aspiration that you have for the work, and what is the satisfaction you gain from what participants gain from it?
Well, firstly, I mean, for me, the work is magical because I have to be, in order to do this work, I have to be completely in the present moment. Because as the work is revealed, people choose other people to represent their family members. And it's like, consulting the oracle. It's all revealed in the moment. And if you have an idea that if this, then that, if that, then this, the work stops immediately. So I can only dance and guide it by being completely in the present, not knowing from one second to the next how I'm going to guide it and what's going to be revealed. So it's a kind of dance in the music of the present, which is the state we all want to be in anyway. So in order to do this work, I have to be, and in doing it, I am. So it's very thrilling for me, and it's very exciting because I never know what's going to happen from one second to the next. So it's completely stimulating as well, and it changes people's lives dramatically. I mean, people come back and do many of them. You know, I do this work in England, and some people have done it 40 times because every time I work with somebody, it's different. Something else is revealed. A whole other area of their life and the picture of the whole sort of ancestral family story, and a whole other aspect of it is revealed and gets worked on. It's never ever the same. So it's an accumulative process and really changes people's lives. The stories I hear from people are miraculous. They really are transformed, and so that's a wonderful thing to be able to, to be able to share in.
And do you feel it has also transformed or changed or deepened your own connection to your own ancestral lineage?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, whenever you work with something, it affects you as well. So I see, I mean, the thing about doing this work is that when the people, you know, I work with each person in turn, and other members are chosen to be members of the family, and then there's a circle of people who aren't working that particular one but are holding the space and you know, are like the healing vessel. So we're all working together all of the time, and we're all witnessing, these particular kind of patterns and stories that everybody that get acted out in each one, I mean, get represented in each situation and revealed, I should say, and worked on and resolved every time. And they're all mythic, you know, they're all they're all stories in mythology in a way, you know. And that's another thing about working over a longer period, you know, the individual sessions become quite mythic. And so when these things are sort of manifested, we all see in each one our own stories, different facets and aspects of our own stories, and they get resolved.
Mm-hmm. That must be such an incredible feeling of being at peace to have that kind of reconciliation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to hear about so much of the work that you do and the history of it and the impact of it. It's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome. Very nice to talk to you.
Okay.
Oh, one thing people should go to my website. I have a lot of information on there, and it's healingvoice.com.
Thank you, and I really hope that I'll have the opportunity to participate at some point in the work that you do.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Stories, awakening, possibility, social impact. Creating a culture of compassion, connection, and collaboration. You are listening to Hollyhock Talks, a podcast about the teachers and luminaries that make Hollyhock extraordinary. Hollyhock is Canada's leading leadership learning center, located on Cortez Island. Hollyhock Talks brings a little piece of Hollyhock magic to you, wherever you are listening.